Hey guys, I'm Heidi Preeb. Welcome back to my channel, or welcome if you're new here. This winter on this channel, we've been talking about rupture, self-recovery, and repair. And today, I want to talk about something that is a very crucial part of that process for all of us, which is figuring out what our underlying needs and feelings are in our close relationships. So today, in particular, we're going to talk about how those feelings and needs show up for those of us on the avoidant side of the attachment spectrum. So that's either dismissive or fearful avoidance. And something that I find is really common for those on this side of the spectrum is not really having much of a clue what anybody is talking about when they're talking about being vulnerable or sharing their needs in relationships. And I think that the reason for that is twofold. So reason number one is that pop culture attachment theory has this kind of unfortunate tendency to paint avoidance as though it's like three anxiously attached people in a trench coat. Okay, which is to say that I see a lot of content out there, including LLMs, if you try processing any attachment stuff with them, making this assumption that if someone's not emoting a lot, they must be actively suppressing or pushing their feelings down. And all they need is some encouragement to open up and share in a more honest way. But this is not at all the conscious inner experience of most avoidants. Okay? Avoidant attachment is almost always the result of growing up in an environment where, from a young age, comfort and connection needs were omitted from conscious processing. So not suppressed and shoved down or ignored, actually omitted, which means that as an adult, when the avoidant attacher is stressed out and they start going through the kind of Rolodex in their head of what might help with the situation they're in, it's not that they're suppressing their connection needs, it's that things like co-regulation just does not show up on that Rolodex. So usually it doesn't even occur to them to reach out and share what they're struggling with. Or if it does occur to them, it might occur to them as something that would actually add to their stress. Because it can kind of feel like, okay, if I share with someone what I'm stressed out about, now not only am I tasked with solving all of my problems, but I'm also tasked with helping this other person self-regulate around the fact that I just told them about my stress. Because they have that natural, I'm okay, you're not okay worldview. And there's a reason why this happens the way it does, right? So avoidant attachers most often, not always, but most often, grew up in environments where their physical needs were cared for, but their emotional needs were not really seen as real or as particularly important by their caregivers. So if they had something like a physical problem, if they were hungry or sick, or if they needed something in a more tangible way, their parents may have been all over it. And because we learn what to pay attention to in our inner world, by tracking what our caregivers paid attention to in our inner world, what that teaches the avoidant is that physical problems are real. So I might need to pay a lot of attention in life to things like my health needs, my safety needs, often as an adult, my financial and security needs. But what the avoidant attacher usually doesn't learn to attune to in themselves from a very young age are their needs for comfort and co-regulation and emotional support from other people. Because if reaching out for emotional support over small things often gets ignored or glossed over by our caregivers, so maybe they kind of get uncomfortable and turn their attention away from us when we're in emotional distress, we learn to see the inner cues that alert us to the need for comfort or emotional containment from other people as not real. The way that other cues like hunger or exhaustion are real. And so our minds and nervous systems naturally start deprioritizing those cues, and we don't pay as much conscious attention on them when they show up in our systems. But what does show up in our conscious awareness is usually the second order effects of ignoring those cues. So what does that mean? It means that normally, when our bodies are logging needs for things like comfort and rest and connection, what happens is that our bodies send cues up to our conscious mind that give us thoughts like, go call a friend and talk to them about your problems, or go get a giant hug from someone, or take the afternoon off work and give yourself a break. Similar to how when we're hungry, our bodies just start thinking about pizza, or maybe a nice salad, or maybe chicken. right? So if we find ourselves in that state where our bodies are logging needs for things like comfort or rest or connection, but our mind has learned to omit those things from our conscious awareness, what will start coming into our conscious awareness are thoughts about things that we have learned to associate with connection, which for avoidance is usually things like get your life together, do a good job at something, find a way to be useful to someone or to a group of people in some way, whatever it is. Because we've learned that is the state that it's okay for us to connect from. Okay, so this is pretty dense stuff, but the really core thing to understand here is that avoidants have basically internalized from a young age that connection is only okay in certain states. So maybe it's okay to connect when I'm feeling good or happy or competent, but it's not okay to connect when I'm feeling angry or grumpy or incompetent or helpless, whatever it is that your nervous system automatically tries to direct your attention away from. So ironically, the more kind of ambient subconscious pain avoidants are in, the more fixated they tend to get on just fixing their lives and sorting out all of their problems as quickly as possible. And then, because they haven't learned to see their close relationships as resources for helping them to co-regulate through that process of fixing their problems, meeting the expectations that come up in their relationships, while simultaneously trying to sort out all of their problems, can start to feel like an unbearable amount of pressure, which is very often the point at which avoidants start to pull back and take space from their relationships. So all of that is to say that reason number one why avoidants usually don't understand what their vulnerable needs and particularly their relational needs are is because they've been unconsciously conditioned from a really young age to see their feelings and interpersonal needs as not quite real in the same way that other problems they might have in the physical realm they see as real. So they often don't really see co-regulation or emotional support as a need that they have at all, because they've just never learned to do it in a deep way. And so they don't have a lot of kind of memories in their body logged as times when that's been helpful. They don't really have that template for it. And it's hard to miss something that we don't know exists, right? At least on a conscious level. Now, just because our physical needs might feel more real to us than our emotional needs doesn't mean we're always great at handling them efficiently. I recently moved cities, which means it's now time for me to find a new doctor, dentist, optometrist, all of that fun stuff. And the part that I normally hate the most about this process is how much time it takes to call around to different offices, trying to figure out who's taking on new patients, who even has availability coming up. It's just one of those tasks where in the past, I've always found doing it really draining, and so I've found myself procrastinating on it. So this time around, I've been using the sponsor of today's video, ZocDoc. ZocDoc is a free website that helps you find and book high-quality in-network doctors, all based on your own preferences. You can search through 200-plus specialties offered on ZocDoc and see which doctors take your insurance, and read reviews from real patients before deciding who feels like the right fit for you. They have over 150,000 providers across all 50 states, covering everything from primary care and dentistry to dermatology and eye care. You can book in-person or video visits and see real-time availability and schedule instantly with no phone calls required. Since moving, I've been using ZocDoc to start narrowing down providers. So reading reviews, filtering by specialty and insurance, and getting a sense of who would actually be a good fit before I book anything. Appointments made through ZocDoc typically happen fast, often within 24 to 72 hours, and sometimes even the same day. They also have the option for in-person or video visits. So if you've been putting off finding a doctor because the whole process feels like too much, you can go to ZocDoc.com/HeidiPreeb, which is also linked in the description, to find and instantly book a top-rated in-network doctor today. All right, so moving back to the topic of emotional needs. The second reason why avoidant attachers often struggle with figuring out what their relational needs are is because avoidants are pretty likely to have a long history of dating people who are more on the anxious side of the attachment spectrum. And anxious attachers can have a tendency to mix up relational needs with self-regulation needs. So they'll be going to their partner with both healthy interpersonal needs, like, hey, can we figure out how to spend some more quality time together so that the relationship keeps feeling connected and fresh? Or can we figure out a way to work through conflict better as a team, whatever it is? But also, they have a tendency to bring needs to their partner that are more personal in nature. So things like helping them calm down and regulate through feelings of pressure or stress, or just wanting a lot of validation of their own desirability, because anxious attachers do tend to have a lot of wounds around not feeling special or chosen. And the avoidant attacher might look at the latter section of needs and go, well, I know how to self-regulate when life gets stressful, and I don't feel that same need for constant reassurance or validation from my partner, so I must not have relational needs the same way that other people do, not realizing that that is not the whole of what relational needs are. Okay, relational needs are essentially any way that we need to be seen or interacted with in order for a relationship to stay both emotionally and practically functional. So if we need to take space every time we subconsciously start feeling not okay, and then we can only allow ourselves to be back in connection in a real and embodied way once we feel good again, it's going to be pretty hard to sustain any relationship that requires consistency. Right? Unless and until we can figure out how to connect with people from different states. So sensitizing ourselves to our feelings and needs as avoidance is not about making ourselves weaker or less capable or reaching inward and trying to pull out pain that otherwise doesn't exist, right? It's just about figuring out what's already going on under the hood for us, letting those things come into conscious awareness, and then giving other people the opportunity to see and relate to us in those emotional states, so that we stop seeing relationships as another challenge that we need to rise to in a perfect way, which compounds our stress, and we start seeing them as things that can function more as a pressure release valve when we're struggling, which again makes them way more integratable into our lives as a whole. So this is about adapting more secure programming, not anxious programming. Okay, secure attachers know how to connect from states like competence and joy, just like avoidants do. But they also know how to connect from states of struggle and uncertainty, like those on the anxious side of the spectrum are generally a little bit better at doing. So they can build these highly resilient connections that can accompany them through various seasons of life. So if those underlying needs for connection and co-regulation are largely being hidden from our conscious awareness, but surfacing them is going to help our relationships get way more sustainable, the natural question that arises next is, how do we go about surfacing those things? So for the rest of this video, we're going to talk about three different trailheads that we can start watching out for in our conscious awareness that might help us connect to what's going on a deeper level for us. And those three trailheads are fantasies about freedom, judgments of other people, and states of extreme pressure and stress when they show up in our awareness. So we're going to start out by talking about fantasies of freedom. So avoidant attachers can have a tendency to romanticize freedom in kind of the same way that anxious attachers can romanticize partnerships. And the reason for that is because both people are romanticizing the state that they feel the least contracted and tense in. Okay, so the anxious attacher might feel like the part of themselves that's usually really hypervigilant can relax when they know that someone who's competent and capable has their back and that they're not going to be alone in their experiences anymore. And then avoidant attachers tend to feel like they can relax when they know that they're not being judged or monitored by anyone and they're not having to kind of rile themselves up to perform the right way to be. And then, just like the anxious attacher can slip into romantic fantasies when they're single, avoidant attachers can slip into fantasies of being free and unburdened by the expectations of a relationship when they're in one. But the important thing to pay attention to here is when those fantasies come up in either case, how does it feel in our bodies to be having those fantasies? So does it feel like a huge exhale where all of this tension drops out of your system and you can finally relax? Or does it feel like a giant rush of excitement and energy, like you can finally mobilize to go explore and try things out without guilt? Or does it feel like a total lightness in the system, knowing that you're finally only having to care for your own experience? And the thing to keep in mind here is that all of those states are states that secure relationships tend to make space for. Because in a secure connection, each person keeps all parts of themselves online. So you're allowed to be a low-functioning version of yourself some days, and it isn't going to freak out or dysregulate the other person to see you struggling. Because secure people assume, of course you struggle sometimes. You're a human being, that's part of the whole thing. Right? But in order to get into that type of relationship, we have to be willing to connect from that place where we're struggling or feeling under-resourced and to admit it, rather than shutting other people out from seeing it. So for a lot of avoidance, that means avoiding the kind of positive wrap-up that you might naturally be inclined to do when you're sharing your experiences, and allowing for a little more space to exist around what you're struggling with in conversations. So that positive wrap-up is the inclination to go, yeah, things have been really tough in this way or that way, but I think it's going to be a really great learning opportunity, or I'm really excited about what's coming next in this area of my life, or whatever it is that you might feel naturally inclined to throw onto the end of a sentence to bring it back to a positive place so that the other person doesn't have to bear the burden of containing your feelings for you. Now, this is a totally fine and situationally appropriate thing to do in conversations with strangers or people that we don't know very well. But if we're chronically doing this in our close relationships, we're also totally bypassing the opportunity to co-regulate. And all we have to do to bake in an opportunity for that is to end the same sentence earlier. Yeah, things have been pretty tough in this area lately. That opens up some space for the other person in the conversation to jump in with a contribution. So they might naturally ask us a follow-up question or share a story about a time when they were struggling with something that was similar. Or maybe ask if there's a way that they can help us out or whatever it is. Or, and this part's important to acknowledge too, you might get a more dysregulated response from someone. So they might jump in and try to really urgently give you advice or change the topic or whatever it is that they do when they don't know how to be present with someone else's discomfort. But all of that is part of the learning process around what different relationships can handle. We offer the opportunity for someone to connect with us from a state of imperfection, and then we see what happens. And the flip side of this coin is that secure relationships are also going to be places where there's lots of room for healthy independence and exploration. So each person retains both their selfhood and their kind of center of gravity in secure relationships. Usually because they have the capacity to cleanly negotiate things like, hey, here's this need that I have. It seems like it's in conflict with one of the needs that you have. So how can we either make the relationship big enough to accommodate both of those things, or just figure out a trade-off that we're both happy enough with, because we know that staying close to each other is more important to each of us than being able to fully and completely express this need in this particular way is. And of course, they don't say that in those exact words, right? Not everybody's a psychologist, but that's the kind of underlying spirit of secure connections. There's an assumption that both people need to stay healthy and whole, and that they're going to have to work together to figure out how to make that happen in the relationship in an ongoing way as life goes on and needs shift over time, right? And so that's our first trailhead, the fantasies that we have about freedom and what's happening in our nervous system when those fantasies come online. We can examine those nervous system states that we might think we can only have access to when we're alone in order to open up a bit more possibility and choice about what it might be like to bring some of those nervous system states into connection and see what happens. Now, the next trailhead we're going to talk about is our judgments about other people. So a quick rule of thumb that I think it helps to keep in mind here is that we rarely feel judgmental about things that are just not personal to us in any way, right? So I don't have any strong opinion about what color of vests Amazon workers should wear because it doesn't impact my life even a little bit. It doesn't impact my day-to-day experience in a practical way, and it also doesn't impact my life in an abstract moral sense. I have no values that get offended if Amazon delivery drivers are wearing green vests or blue vests. But where I do tend to hold judgments is areas where people's actions affect me in some way. So a very quick hack that I've figured out for getting closer to what my underlying feelings are is noticing when a conscious judgment of someone surfaces in my awareness, letting it be there exactly as it is for a moment, and then asking myself the question, what's it to me? So there's this coach I used to work with who loved to pull out that particular line. So whenever a client he was working with would either start ranting about something or just in general start talking at length about someone else's experience, he would go, great, thanks for letting me know. What's it to you? As in, why in this moment are you feeling so invested in the way that that other person is behaving? What part of that is personal to you? So I'll give a concrete example. When I was in university doing my undergrad degree, so I would have been around 18 or 19 at this point, there was this one spring break where I decided to spend some of the money that I'd been saving for my campus job and go on a university trip to Mexico. So I signed up, as did a group of my close friends who I'd talked into joining me, and then I went back to my campus job the Monday morning after signing up and was telling my closest work friend about it. And she was like, oh yeah, that sounds really cool. And then a couple of days later, I'm back at my job. That same coworker comes in and she goes, hey, great news. I talked to my parents and they said they could give me the money to go on that spring break trip too. So I'm thinking about signing up. And I felt this total paralysis as soon as she said that, which I could not figure out because I really liked this work friend a lot. But I could tell as soon as she said those words that I did not want her to come on the trip. And all of this was happening at a time in my life that was long before the era where I had any vocabulary for attachment or for my inner world and feelings. So I just did what I tended to do anytime I was feeling uncomfortable with something that I thought I shouldn't be feeling uncomfortable with. And I went, awesome, it would be so much fun to have you on that trip. And then something interesting happened, which is that when I went home that night, I noticed all of these new stories about my coworker starting to form in my head. So she was someone who, up until that point, I'd really liked a lot and had a lot of respect for. But that night, I started thinking things like, oh, I didn't realize she was so clingy. Why can't she just get her own life and her own friends to go on trips with? And all of these really negative and judgmental thoughts that I'd never had about this person before. And because I had very few self-awareness or conflict resolution skills at the time, I never figured out what was going on for me on a deeper level. I just went on the spring break trip with my coworker and felt annoyed that she was there the entire time. But looking back on that all of these years later, there's something that's so obvious to me now that was not obvious back then, which is that I was jealous of this coworker. I liked her a lot inside of our work bubble, but I also had this idea that everything in life just came easier to her than it did to me. Like she came from a family that had more money than mine, and she had this natural kind of charm and warmth that I didn't have. And when I was around her in group environments, I felt both inadequate next to her and a little resentful that I had to work so hard at so many of the things that just tended to come more naturally to her. And of course, none of that was her fault. Right? Nor was she doing anything overtly wrong. And so in my system of values, as they existed at the time, I had no right to feel anything negative towards her or to talk to her about anything that was coming up for me. But looking back all of these years later, I so wonder what would have happened if I'd just told that coworker what was going on for me in that situation. Which doesn't mean asking her not to come so I could avoid my own trigger, right? But just letting her in on what was going on under the surface. So the fact that some part of me was comparing myself to her and judging myself on the ways that I felt like I was always coming up short. And maybe even letting her know that it was giving me complicated feelings about the trip that I felt guilty about and really didn't want to have. Because at the end of the day, those feelings weren't about her, right? They were about me. I was torturing myself inside my own mind with this idea that I had to do life just as well as everybody else around me, even though I was struggling at the time on a daily basis with things like my mental health, at some points my physical health, my finances, and all of these other compounding stressors that had followed me to university. And all of that information is the kind of stuff that would have given her the chance to actually get to know me, which would have opened up the opportunity for connection beyond that one state that I was used to connecting with her from, which was that state of I'm all good and everything is fine and I am feeling the right thing at all times. And who knows, maybe that conversation would have opened up some space for her to share what she was struggling with me if she wanted to. But the point that we're getting at here is that there's very often intimate information about us hiding behind our judgments of other people. So what's it to me can be one step in uncovering what our judgments are about on a deeper level. What's it to me if this person is clingy? What's it to me if this person can't self-regulate? What state does it put me in when that person is behaving that way? And what's it like for me to be in that state? And then, if we want to start building intimacy, can I share the answer to those questions with this other person about what it's like to be me in this uncomfortable state? That might actually go a really long way towards deepening our connection, if that's what I'm wanting to do. Now, the final trailhead we're going to talk about today for surfacing our deeper feelings as avoidant attachers is examining what's going on for us when we feel pressure. So again, pressure tends to be one of those feelings that is totally quintessential to the avoidant experience. So it's one that tends to live right on the surface and that shows up pretty often to remind us of that gap between where we are and where we feel like we should be. So either where we are with our lives relative to where we feel like we should be, or where we are with our feelings in a relationship relative to where we feel like we should be, whatever it is that we are currently putting pressure on ourselves to get right. And something it took me a really long time to realize is that pressure usually comes not from doing too many things or taking on too many projects alone, but from omitting too much of my internal experience from the process of whatever it is that I'm doing. So maybe I'm trying to get a massive work project done, and I'm telling myself that I can't relax or enjoy myself until I've hit this particular goal and really earned that stuff. Right? But the parts of me that are exhausted or that are needing that comfort en route to that goal don't just go away. Okay? I have to exert more and more mental and emotional energy trying to suppress those parts the longer I ignore them for. And so that's the difference between a state of pressure and a state of flow. In both states, we might genuinely be performing at a high level and getting a lot of stuff done, but a flow state accounts for the whole of us when we're in it. So there's no internal feelings or experiences being sectioned off or left out in a significant way, which allows for that whole body experience of ease and engagement. Whereas pressure is what happens when we have a high self-expectation paired with hardcore compartmentalization or suppression. And so the good news here is that experiencing that conscious feeling of pressure can actually serve as another trailhead. So we can ask ourselves, what do I think I can't feel? Or what state am I not allowing myself to relax into until I've accomplished this goal or met my expectation in this relationship or whatever it is? How many perfect partner points do I have to log before I can bring up one thing I'm upset about? Right? So there was a point in my life where I was working as a ghostwriter, and the way that I was doing it was just really high pressure. So I had super tight turnaround times on projects, and I had really high expectations for myself about my work, and I was getting incredibly burnt out incredibly quickly. And during that period, I started having these really weird impulses about how I wanted to do my work. Like I would wake up and feel like I wanted to go right in the bathtub for 3 hours. Or I wanted to make a huge elaborate meal and jot down my thoughts between chopping vegetables. And what I eventually realized my system was doing was it was starting to look for these little loopholes that it could smuggle things like relaxation and regulation back into my life through. Okay, because I wasn't making time or space for those things. At least not until my work was done. And the way that I set up my life, my work was never done. And so this is a perfect metaphor for what avoidant attachers tend to do in relationships. Some part of the system goes, okay, there are parts of myself that I just need to turn offline in order to do this relationship the right way. And then those freedom fantasies sneak in to give us those kind of mental microdoses of those feelings or those nervous system states that we've been omitting. And the cool thing is that once we start seeing that pattern, so when we can start to recognize that pressure is actually a signal that some very important part of us is being sectioned off from our experience in the relationship, then we can start looking at that pressure as a clue about what deeper feelings might be wanting to come online for us, or which ones might need to have more room made for them inside of the relationship in order for it to become comfortable and sustainable in a long-term way. So whenever I find myself feeling a lot of pressure, either in a relationship or at work or whatever it is, I like to just ask myself the question, how can I bring more of what I'm leaving out of this whole situation into it? So if I'm sitting down to film a YouTube video, but I'm feeling kind of sad, and I'm pressuring myself to get upbeat and happy again so that I can film, I might ask myself the question, what if I just filmed this video from a bit of a sad or downregulated energy today that allows me to stay in connection with the project that I'm working on without losing my authenticity or having to change my state? If I'm putting off calling someone because I feel stressed out, what if I gave them a quick call and just said, hey, I miss you and I really want to connect and I'm super stressed out right now and don't have a lot of time. Do you have 5 to 10 minutes? If I'm in a situation where I'm feeling distracted or not present because there's something else going on in some other area of my life that's not relevant, can I just name that out loud and let the people around me know, hey, I want to be really present and I'm also feeling really distracted by this other thing that's going on for me in another area of my life? So bringing in more of what we're trying to leave out in a lot of cases can go a long way in both keeping us more present and giving us more opportunities to connect with people from an authentic state where we're actually congruent. And so people can feel that what we're saying and what we're feeling are in alignment. And that also tends to go a really long way in the direction of building trust. All right, so those three different ways of surfacing our feelings are all bringing us to the final point that we're going to talk about today, which is getting connected to your relational needs as an avoidant. And in some way, that is what we've been talking about the whole time. So our relational needs are really just any way in which we need to be seen or supported in a relationship in order to stay in it long term without having to fragment ourselves or chronically disconnect from it. So another way of saying that is that relational needs are agreements that we make with another person about how we can stay in connection across a long period of time while preserving each person's sense of wholeness. And to figure out what our specific relational needs are, all we really have to do is look at where we naturally disconnect from connection and why. So if you tend to avoid people when you're feeling depressed, being seen and known in your depression is a relational need for you. It's what allows you to stay in connection with people while maintaining your authenticity. So without having to wait for your state to change to get back into connection. Or if you tend to pull back when you're feeling angry or annoyed with someone, being able to talk about what frustrates you, ideally in a respectful way, is a relational need for you. It's what allows you to stay in connection while maintaining your authenticity and without having to wait for your state to change. Or if you only feel comfortable in relationships where you feel like you're kind of calling the shots and are in control of the relational dynamic, learning to take someone else's lead in a humble way is a relational need for you. Okay, it's what allows you to stay in connection without having to control another person's response, which allows both of you to stay in your authenticity and to not have to change states. And if we're working our way towards secure, the goal is not to start bringing our relational needs into every single connection, right? Maybe we're not trying to preserve a connection with our boss or our coworker where we bring in every single thing that we're feeling during the workday. But when it comes to those deep, intimate connections that we want to keep with us throughout different seasons of our lives, this is the kind of stuff that it becomes really important to be able to let other people in on. Relational needs are about how the relationship needs to expand and become big enough to include the full nervous system range of both people. And that often takes some creativity to be able to get right, especially to be able to get it right over and over and over again. And so this is why I wanted to spend so much time on recognizing and getting in touch with our feelings in this video, because experiencing the full range of our feelings is what allows us to stay regulated, It's what keeps all of our nervous systems in homeostasis. And our relational needs are just the conditions under which our system can stay both regulated and connected to another person at the same time, so that we don't have to automatically disconnect every time we encounter one of those states that we think is incompatible with connection. It's about challenging the fact that those two things are at odds at all. All right, this video could go on for quite a while because there is so much to say about this topic, but I think that we've already covered quite a bit for today. So we're going to move into a quick little summary and wrap up. The overarching takeaway from this video is that becoming aware of our feelings and needs as avoidant attachers is not about becoming more helpless or dramatic or dependent in a way that we can't redeem ourselves from. It's just about letting more of ourselves be included and seen in connection. So figuring out which feelings we authentically have online that might just be coming out sideways through things like judgments or fantasies or inhibitions, and then figuring out how we can bring more of what's actually happening for us beneath the surface into our close relationships, so that we don't need to chronically disconnect from them in order to stay in them long term. Which once again gives us that template that we can use if and when we want to for having long term relationships that have the grit to actually last. All right, as always, any questions or any thoughts that you've had as you've gone through this video, or any curiosities that have been popping up, please leave them in the comment section below. I love you guys. I hope you're taking care of yourselves and each other, and I will see you back here again really soon.